Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So if you've been around for the past decade or so, you've certainly heard about cryptocurrencies. People have heard about, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum, but there's this whole gigantic world of minor cryptocurrencies beyond that. And they attract a lot of controversy because I think that there is a feeling sometimes that they are, you know, the province of online criminals and just used for wrongdoing. And then you've got kind of a line of commentary that I think is almost anarchist, saying that, you know, the central currencies are all a scam and the government has no business in interjecting itself into our most basic means of transfer of exchange. And that whole concept, distributed everything, is the answer. I haven't really engaged that much with the whole world of cryptocurrency as a sort of tech, I guess you could say, tech diehard. It's one thing that actually hasn't really interested me to a great extent. I have a cryptocurrency wallet, and I think I have like 100 shekels in it. That's like 20 bucks, whatever that equals to. So essentially nothing. And I have it just to have it in case there's some reason to use it and to have an address. But beyond that, in my day-to-day life, I've never really understood what the sort of advantages would be. Something that I would, however, I am definitely, I would say, anti-cash. I try to pay everything that I can digitally. And I'm frustrated when, I think we did talk about this previously, when you try to access your own financial data, whether it's you're looking to budget or really just know what you're spending. And part of my reason in being, let's say, anti-cash is I would have thought that if you do everything digitally, you're creating digital breadcrumbs. And I actually mean that in a good way. It means that your transactions are being verified. And if you collect that data, you can get trends and analysis. If you're just spending cash, you know, you're not going to have a record in that sense. For some people, that's precisely the reason that they want to use cash. I'm looking at it from the other perspective. But that's actually often not the case. We talked about this before, that in PayPal, the merchant API, if you're selling on PayPal, you can get your transaction data. If you're just a chump buying stuff on PayPal, you can't. And likewise for Google, you expect that if you use Google Wallet, I use it all the time, please don't hack me, that you're going to be able to like do an export or connect to an API and get your data. And then you see it's not the case. And you say, well, if all this stuff is traveling through Google, shouldn't I be able to, isn't that my data? And the answer is that we don't have a very evolved concept yet of data sovereignty when it comes to our own personal transaction records, that I think is a great pity. It's changing, but it's not there yet. So with cryptocurrencies, I guess the idea that does appeal to me is sovereign-backed digital currencies. So we're talking about where the government steps in and says that we're going to stop with this business of printing, you know, banknotes and metal. And we have seen in Israel actually some quite significant legislation trying to stamp out the gray economy through basically making it illegal to use cash for kind of reasons that using cash would raise it very high to an almost certitude that you're trying to evade paying tax. So that law has been there, and that's another dimension to it. But I know that Israel has been considering the idea of having its own sovereign digital currency. In other words, a fiat-backed currency. I'm not a financier, so I don't know. I know the gold standard was abandoned. But how do people who are into crypto feel about this concept is a kind of the, you know, the ugly twin of cryptocurrencies that the government is kind of belatedly acknowledging that it's a good idea, or is it something that enjoys widespread support? And beyond countries that have announced kind of their pilot programs and maybe standards for it and consultations, which governments are much more advanced in the process, and how's it going for them? Herman and Corin, let's talk about sovereign digital currencies in today's episode of My Weird Prompts.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, and I am sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother. It is Monday, January 26th, 2026, and the winter air outside is crisp, but we have got the heater going and a very heavy topic on the table.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. It is a beautiful day in the Holy City, but as usual, we are staying inside to dive into the digital weeds. Today's prompt is actually quite relevant to our current surroundings, especially given some of the news coming out of the Bank of Israel lately.
Yeah, our housemate Daniel sent us a really thoughtful audio note this week. He was talking about his preference for digital transactions over cash, specifically because of the data trail it leaves. He likes the idea of being able to analyze his own spending habits. You know, Daniel, he loves a good spreadsheet, but he is also looking at the bigger picture of data sovereignty. He is worried that while he gets the data, he might be losing the control.
It is a classic Daniel question. He is always looking for that intersection of personal utility and high-level tech policy. He wanted to know about sovereign-backed digital currencies, often called central bank digital currencies, and how the actual cryptocurrency community feels about them here in 2026. Is it a cheap government imitation? Or is it the logical next step for the global financial system?
And he also asks which governments are leaving the pack and what their experience has been so far. This is a massive topic, Herman. We have touched on digital security and hardware vaults in recent episodes, like episode 300, but this goes right to the heart of what money actually is in the mid-20s.
It really does. And I think we should start by addressing that first part of Daniel's question, how do the crypto enthusiasts feel? Because if you go to a Bitcoin conference today or hang out in decentralized finance forums, the reaction to central bank digital currencies is, well, it is complicated. It is a mix of validation and deep-seated suspicion.
I imagine it is pretty polarizing. On one hand, you have the people who got into crypto specifically to get away from government control. For them, a digital currency issued by a central bank is basically the ultimate boss fight villain, right? It is the state taking the very tools meant to liberate us and using them to tighten a leash.
Exactly. In those circles, they often call them surveillance coins. The argument is that while Bitcoin offers a degree of pseudonymity and a fixed supply that no government can mess with, a central bank digital currency is the exact opposite. It gives the state total visibility into every single transaction in real time. If the government can see every coffee you buy, every book you read, every donation you make, that is a level of insight that traditional cash never allowed. It is the end of financial privacy as we know it.
But Daniel's point was that he actually likes the data. He wants the records for his own analysis. So, is there a segment of the crypto world that sees this as a win? Like, hey, the government is finally admitting that our technology is superior?
There is definitely a told-you-so element. You have the more institutional or pragmatic side of the crypto world that sees central bank digital currencies as a massive validation of distributed ledger technology. They argue that if the world's major economies move to a blockchain or a similar ledger system, it will bridge the gap between traditional finance and decentralized finance. It makes on-ramps and off-ramps much smoother. If your digital dollars and your digital Bitcoin live on similar technical rails, moving between them becomes trivial.
So, it is less of an imitation and more of an evolution of the existing fiat system using crypto's tools, like the state finally upgrading its legacy software.
That is how the proponents see it. But the friction comes from the word sovereignty. In the crypto world, sovereignty usually means individual sovereignty or self-sovereignty. You own your keys, you own your money. In the world of central bank digital currencies, sovereignty refers to the state. The state maintains the power to freeze accounts, reverse transactions, or even set expiration dates on money to stimulate spending. It is a top-down model versus a bottom-up one.
Wait, you mentioned expiration dates on money earlier. That sounds like a science fiction trope. Is that actually happening in 2026?
It is more than a trope. It is a very real policy tool being discussed and even tested. It is called programmable money. Imagine if a government wants to issue a stimulus package, but they want to make sure people actually spend it to boost the economy instead of just saving it or paying down debt. With a central bank digital currency, they could technically program those specific units of currency to lose value or vanish if they are not spent within 6 months. We have seen early versions of this in some of the Chinese pilots, where red envelopes of digital yuan had to be used by a certain date.
That is fascinating and terrifying at the same time. It completely changes the store of value function of money. If my money has an egg timer on it, it is not really a store of value anymore. It is more like a coupon. But let's look at Daniel's interest in data sovereignty. If I am using a government digital currency, do I actually have more control over my data than I do with, say, a credit card or a private app like PayPal?
That is the million-dollar question, and it is where the implementation details really matter. Right now, if you use a credit card, your data is owned by the bank and the payment processor. They sell that data, they use it for credit scoring, they analyze it. Proponents of central bank digital currencies argue that a well-designed system could actually be more private than a commercial bank. They suggest a two-tier system where the central bank sees the total flow, but individual identities are shielded by a layer of privacy-preserving technology unless there is a warrant.
I feel like we have heard the unless there is a warrant line before, and it rarely ends with more privacy for the user. But I see the logic. If the government is the provider, they are not necessarily motivated by the same profit incentives to sell your data to advertisers that a private bank might be. They have other motivations, of course, but maybe not that specific one.
Potentially. But then you have the other side of the coin. If the government has a direct ledger of all transactions, they do not need to ask a bank for your records. They already have them. So, for someone like Daniel, who wants to analyze his own records, a central bank digital currency might provide a very clean, standardized application programming interface for his personal finance apps. He could grant his budgeting software Red only access to his official sovereign ledger, but he is trading that convenience for a direct line of sight from the tax authorities and the regulators. It is the ultimate transparency, for better or worse.
Let's pivot to who is actually doing this. We are sitting here in Jerusalem, and I know the Bank of Israel has been looking into a digital shekel for years. What is the status as of today?
Israel is actually a great example of a country that is being very methodical. They have been running Project Icebreaker, which is a collaboration with the central banks of Norway and Sweden and the Bank for International Settlements. The goal there was to see how different central bank digital currencies could talk to each other for cross-border payments. And more recently, Project Sela showed that you could have a retail digital currency that supports competition while retaining some of the privacy features of cash.
Because right now, sending money to another country is a nightmare of correspondent banking and high fees. If I want to send money to our cousins in the States, it takes 3 days and costs a fortune.
Exactly. It can take days and cost a significant percentage of the total. Project Icebreaker showed that you could settle these transactions in seconds using a hub and spoke model with digital currencies. As for the digital shekel itself, the Bank of Israel has a roadmap for implementation starting this year, 2026. They are particularly interested in how it could encourage competition in the payment market, which is currently dominated by a few large banks here. They want to break that oligopoly by giving fintech startups direct access to the central bank's ledger.
It feels like the smaller, more tech-forward nations are the ones leading the way. But what about the big players? China is the one we always hear about in the news.
China is the undisputed leader in terms of scale. Their currency is the ECNY, or the digital yuan. As of late 2025, they had processed over 3.4 billion transactions worth roughly $2.4 trillion. That is a staggering amount of volume. And here is the big news from just a few weeks ago. As of January 1, 2026, the People's Bank of China began allowing commercial banks to pay interest on digital yuan holdings.
Wait, interest on digital cash? That is a huge shift.
It is massive. It effectively transitions the ECNY from being just digital cash to being a digital deposit currency. it makes it much more attractive for people to keep their savings in the government's digital wallet rather than a traditional bank account. They've integrated it into the apps people already use, like WeChat Pay and Alipay, but they are pushing hard to make the eCNY the primary rail.
So, for the average person in Shanghai, does it feel any different than using a regular digital wallet?
On the surface, not really. But the underlying architecture is different. It is a direct liability of the People's Bank of China, and the government has been very open about the fact that it helps them combat money laundering and illegal activities. In practice, it gives the central bank a real-time heat map of the entire economy. They can see exactly where money is flowing, which sectors are heating up, and which are cooling down with zero delay. It is a level of macroeconomic control that a central banker from the 1980s could only dream of.
That sounds like a double-edged sword. Great for managing inflation, maybe, but a nightmare for anyone worried about state overreach. What about India? I know they have been moving fast on digital payments, too.
India is the other giant in the room. Their e-rupee pilot hit over 1 million daily transactions by late 2025. They are actually proposing to link the digital currencies of all the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, at the upcoming 2026 summit. They want to create an alternative to the US dollar-dominated SWIFT system. It is a geopolitical power play as much as a technical one.
And what about the US? Are we going to see a digital dollar anytime soon?
The United States is in a very different position. In January 2025, President Trump issued an executive order that actually prohibited federal agencies from promoting or issuing a central bank digital currency. There is a lot of political pushback in the U.S., with politicians citing concerns about financial privacy and the weaponization of the banking system. So while the Fed is still doing technical research projects like Project Hamilton and Project Cedar, they are nowhere near a public launch. The U.S. is currently the wait-and-see flavor of the month.
It is interesting that the U.S., which usually leads in tech, is so hesitant here. But I guess when you hold the world's reserve currency, you have the most to lose if you mess it up. If the digital dollar has a bug, the whole world feels it.
Exactly. Plus, the private banking lobby in the U.S. is incredibly powerful. If people can keep their money directly with the Federal Reserve in a digital wallet, why would they need a checking account at a commercial bank? This is called disintermediation, and it is the bank's worst nightmare.
Oh, that is a huge point. It could trigger a massive bank run where everyone moves their deposits from private banks to the risk-free central bank account.
Precisely. To prevent this, most central banks, including the European Central Bank, are looking at two-tier models. The commercial banks still hold the accounts and manage the customer service, but the money itself is the digital currency. Or they might put limits on how much digital currency an individual can hold, say, 3,000 euros. That way, you can use it for your daily coffee and groceries, but you cannot keep your life savings there.
So it is like a digital wallet with a cap. That seems like a compromise that might make the banks happy, but might frustrate users who want the safety of the central bank for all their money.
It is a very delicate balancing act. Speaking of the digital euro, the legislation for it is expected to be finalized later this year in 2026, with a pilot exercise starting in 2027. They are really focusing on privacy as the number one selling point, trying to win over a skeptical European public.
Let's go back to Daniel's point about analyzing transaction records. If I am a developer, or just a data nerd like Daniel, what does the experience of a central bank digital currency look like compared to current banking?
Hopefully, it looks like a standardized open application programming interface. Right now, if you want to pull your data from three different banks, you have to use a third-party aggregator like Plaid, which is often clunky and has its own privacy issues. A central bank digital currency could provide a sovereign way to access your own data. You could grant a budgeting app read-only access to your official ledger. It would be cleaner, faster, and more accurate because the format would be a piece of national infrastructure, like the roads with a power grid.
And since it is sovereign, the format wouldn't change every time a bank updates its website. It would be a stable foundation for innovation.
Exactly. But this brings us to the technical middle ground that I find really interesting: programmable privacy. Some central bank digital currency designs use something called zero-knowledge proofs. We have talked about this before, but in the context of money, it would allow you to prove that you have enough money for a transaction and that you paid your taxes on it without revealing your entire transaction history or your identity to the merchant. It is the digital equivalent of handing over a $20 bill. The merchant knows it is real, but they do not know who you are or what else is in your wallet.
Okay, now that is a feature I think most crypto people could get behind. If a central bank digital currency actually implemented robust zero-knowledge proofs, it could technically be more private than a physical credit card.
Theoretically, yes. But would a government actually build that? Most governments want the opposite. They want more visibility, not less. The challenge is finding that sweet spot where small offline transactions are private, like cash, but larger transactions are tracked to prevent crime.
Wait, you mentioned offline transactions again. How do you do a digital transaction without the internet? If I'm in a basement or the power is out, how do I buy that loaf of bread?
This is one of the biggest technical hurdles. India has been testing this using near-field communication technology, where you can basically tap two phones together to transfer the value directly, chip to chip. The value is stored in a secure hardware element on your phone. Once you reconnect to the grid, the ledger updates. It is a digital version of the coins in your pocket.
That sounds exactly like the hardware vault we discussed in episode 300. If that chip is compromised, or if the government has a backdoor into it, your sovereign money isn't very sovereign at all.
Spot on. The security of the hardware in your pocket becomes the security of your entire financial life. If we move to a world of central bank digital currencies, the trust shifts from the commercial bank to the hardware manufacturer and the central bank's code. It is a massive shift in the trust architecture of society.
So, looking at the global landscape in 2026, it seems like we have a few different flavors. You have the control flavor in China, the inclusion flavor in the Bahamas and Nigeria. Though adoption there has been a struggle because people still prefer Bitcoin or US dollar stablecoins, and the efficiency flavor being tested in Europe and Israel.
That is a perfect summary. And then you have the US, which is currently the strategic reserve flavor, where they are looking at Bitcoin as a reserve asset while blocking a digital dollar. It is a wild, fragmented world right now.
So, to answer Daniel's question, the crypto world mostly views central bank digital currencies with a mix of I told you so and stay away from me. But for the average person, it is going to be the most significant change in how we interact with the economy since the invention of the credit card.
Maybe even since the invention of paper money itself. We are moving from analog tokens to programmable claims. It is a wild time to be alive, and I think Daniel is right to be asking about data sovereignty now, while these systems are still being designed.
You know, it reminds me of what we discussed back in episode 298 about hardware trust and the provenance of data. If you cannot trust the ledger, you cannot trust the money. And if you cannot trust the money, you cannot trust the society built on it.
Well said. And for anyone listening who wants to dive deeper into the technical side, I highly recommend looking at the Bank for International Settlements website. They have some incredibly detailed papers on the architecture of a central bank digital currency. It is nerdy, but it is the blueprint for the future of your wallet.
Thanks for the deep dive, Herman. I feel like I understand Daniel's prompt a lot better now. It is not just about digital versus cash, it is about who controls the ledger of our lives. And hey, if you are listening and you found this helpful, or if you have your own weird prompt about the future of tech, we would love to hear from you. Yeah, you can reach out to us through the contact form at myweirdprompts.com. And if you have a moment, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really does help other curious people find the show.
We genuinely appreciate the support. This has been My Weird Props. I am Herman Puppleberry.
And I am Korn. Thanks to Daniel for the great prompt, and thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you next week.
Until then, stay curious.
And keep your keys safe. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.